Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A little bit of turnabout play today on Research on Religion. For the past 2.5 years, you have heard me interview over 135 guests. You may not realize that prior to starting this podcast, I was a professorial scholar at the University of Washington. I still am, and as part of my job, both past and present, I produce interesting research on various topics. Today, I thought it'd be fun to discuss my most recent book, The Political Origins of Religious Liberty, which was actually published in 2008. Part of the reason for doing this is because I'd like to tell you folks what I do in my spare time, but also to provide you with a little taste of what I consider to be an interesting topic, and hopefully you will head out to buy a copy of my book. Yeah, I'm a shameless promoter in that regard, as I would like to sell more books, not only to get my ideas out to a broad public, but also to pick up a few royalties so that I can give them to my favorite charity, Feed the Child, meaning my own child, who I need to feed. So, what I've done today is to invite one of my good friends and colleagues, Steve Pfaff, onto the show to serve as guest host. He knows my work fairly well, probably better than I do now, and he is also one of my most favorite sociologists. Everybody needs to have one sociologist as a friend, and I pick Steve. He is a storehouse of historical knowledge on just about every topic and one of the best storytellers that I know. Steve is a professor of sociology at the University of Washington and the author of a number of articles that look into religion. But as mentioned, his storehouse of knowledge is broad and deep, and he has also studied things as varied as mutinies aboard 18th century British ships to the fall of the Berlin Wall in the 1980s, which he published in the form of an award-winning book entitled Exit Voice Dynamics and the Collapse of East Germany. Steve has also appeared twice before on our podcast discussing the Reformation and a grab bag of issues related to the sociology of religion. I will link to those earlier appearances on our website as well as to his other work, so please pay us a visit. But right now, I'm going to get out of the host chair, literally, and go sit in the guest chair and turn things over to Professor Pfaff. Steve, take it away. Oh, and be nice.
Okay, so we're moving here now, and we're getting up and moving.
All right. Here we are. I am now sitting in the guest chair, and Steve is heading over to the host chair. We have special chairs designated for this. So, Steve.
Welcome to Research on Religion. My name is Steve Pfaff, and I've now moved over to the interviewer's chair. But before I begin, I wish to say a little bit about my colleague, Tony Gill. Anthony Gill is professor of political science at the University of Washington and a non-resident scholar at Baylor University's Institute for the Study of Religion. He was awarded a PhD from the University of California at Los Angeles in 1994 and has since taught at the University of Washington, where he has been recognized as an outstanding instructor. Gill is the author of numerous articles and two books, Rendering Unto Caesar, published in 1998, A Study of the Catholic Church and the State in Latin America, and more recently, The Political Origins of Religious Liberty, published by Cambridge University Press in 2007. In light of current events worldwide, Professor Gill's book seems to have added relevance. Issues related to religious liberty and the politics of religion have been at the forefront of struggles to democratize authoritarian polities in the wake of the Arab Spring. And reports have been made of Putin's Russia using public security laws to restrict religious minorities. And recently here in the United States, vocal opposition to women's health care mandates led religious conservatives to claim that religious freedom was under attack. But tell us, Tony, what is religious liberty?
That's a good question to start off with, because most people seem to have a very dichotomous view of what religious liberty is. We think here in the United States of our First Amendment that it says you have religious liberty, freedom of conscience, freedom of worship, and we tend to view it as an on-off switch. You either have it or you don't, but it really constitutes a wide range of things. And as I've been studying this topic over the past 2 decades, I've been really surprised at how many different ways governments have in their arsenal to restrict religious liberties. And so when it comes to thinking about religious liberty, I like to think of it as a continuum. And being a political economist, I also like to think of things in economic terms. So for me, religious liberty tends to be anything, any policy, regulation, or law that raises the cost to a religious individual or a group in order to for them to go and do about their daily business. So it could be run a wide range of different things. One, to prohibiting you from being associated with any specific religion, that adds a significant cost to somebody. So, well, if I want to be a Catholic, no, you can't be a Catholic in this state. Well, that's a cost to you. To a number of other things, one of the things that I've been recently interested in is property issues, where governments will say, yes, we have freedom of conscience. You can believe what you want. And that's pretty hard to police. You can't really police what's in people's head. But when it comes to the freedom of worship, of expressing what you have in your head with other individuals that you congregate together, you usually need a place to meet at. And governments abroad and even here in the United States, local municipalities, counties, and states have used property laws, zoning regulations in very creative ways that raise the cost of worshiping, in essence. You know, I can give you one example of this is that if you have zoning regulations that say you cannot build a church within city limits, it has to be built out in the countryside. Well, that's maybe 5, 6, 7 miles away from a big residential area. And you say, ah, what's the big deal about that? But as we find out, just moving a church building or even a store or any other type of building a few miles away from where people are living, it can have a pretty dramatic effect on whether or not people attend. And so where you locate a church can become a huge issue. And I've run across a number of other issues with religious liberty too, where certain religions are restricted from having loudspeakers. This was an issue that came up in Switzerland with Muslims and on the minarets, and that restricts their ability to do things. And there might be reasonable reasons for doing some of these things. You don't want noise. There's noise restrictions. Things run into other people. But oftentimes you see that many of these laws are used to raise the cost to religious individuals or to religious groups and make it a little bit more difficult for them to go about their daily business of worship. And so that's what I consider religious liberty to be.
All right. So that makes sense. I mean, if we think of this as a continuum, on the one hand, there could be various kinds of regulations or restrictions that raise costs so that it's not impossible to practice religion, but becomes more costly. On the other hand of the spectrum, it must also include cases where, or instances in which, the cost of organizing religion or worshiping or taking part in religion is almost prohibitive. I mean, if we think about, for example, Mao's China during the Cultural Revolution,
right,
or Stalin's Soviet Union, in those cases, one could think of it as regulation, but these are regulations so severe that temples are destroyed, priests murdered, put in mm-hmm. prison, even simple adherents severely discriminated against, if not beaten or thrown in jail, then given some kind of limits on their career opportunities and the like. I mean, very, very severe restrictions on the
right.
on the other end of that spectrum.
Well, one thing I should break in here too and mention is that there's always going to be some restrictions on religious liberty in any society. You can't have pure religious freedom because it's going to bump up into a number of other laws. For instance, you can't have religious liberty that allows for a religious group that goes around and sacrifices human beings, right? That seems against societal norms. It goes against laws against murder and all these other things. So there's going to be some limit on religious liberty. And that's why I like to see it as a continuum, saying that, well, you know, no country is purely religiously free. That would just be anarchy, and most societies wouldn't tolerate that. But on the other hand, we can see that some societies make it more restrictive for religious groups to practice relative to other religious groups. Maybe some are favored, maybe some are not favored. And that brings up another issue that we oftentimes don't think about in terms of religious liberty. I just talked a lot about the negative liberties of the government is prevented from doing certain things to religious groups. But there's also this sense that governments will subsidize or favor certain religions over other religions. They will provide funding for them. They'll provide special privileges in terms of buildings, tax exempt status for one denomination but not for another. And this doesn't seem to many people to be a violation of religious freedom, as long as, well, everybody can set up a church as they see fit, but one denomination, a state-sponsored church, gets a little bit more. And that actually I view as a restriction on religious liberty as well, because when the state gets into the game of picking one religion over another religion, it makes it difficult for a new entrant, a new religious group to come in and say, hey, we have some better ideas here, because people in the society say, no, you know, my taxes, they're already going for this church. And so if I attend your church, I have to pay taxes for that church, and then I got to tithe for your church. Oh, that's too much. And so that oftentimes acts as what us economists would call a barrier to entry into the religious market, even though we don't necessarily think of that as being a religious liberty issue.
Seems to me another issue has to do, and you spoke of the difference between religious negative religious freedoms and positive religious freedoms. So if we think about religious liberty as freedom from something versus freedom to do something, nearly every government around the world today has enshrined in its constitution or other government founding document some notion that there's freedom of conscience or freedom of expression. But in practice, that often means that some groups, whether it's minorities, dissenters, the like, don't really have freedom to. They might have freedom of private conscience, but when they wish to speak publicly or proselytize or advocate or try to open up a place of worship, then the restrictions become apparent.
Yeah, and there's been a number of scholars who've looked into that and really opened that box in terms of empirical research. I'm thinking of Brian Grimm and Roger Finke, as well as Jonathan Fox out in Israel. We've had them on our show as guests in the past, and they've set out to measure the dimensions of religious freedom. And the first thing they note is that, well, pretty much everybody who has a constitution in the world today has religious freedom. But you know, when you start looking at it a little bit more closely, then you start to realize, maybe we don't have religious freedom. So, yeah, that's
Now, as a political economist, you mentioned a lot about issues related to regulation and issues related to restrictions that can affect the cost of doing business, so to speak, or the cost of going about the business of religion. Now, when we raise issues of regulation, that, of course, presumes the state and the role of the state. All right. So then we have to ask the question, what would motivate some states to offer relatively broad definition of religious liberty or relatively broad practical rights to free religious expression or free religious enterprise, while other states seem to be highly motivated to restrict it? Mm-hmm. What's the difference? What motivates some states or the leaders of some states to permit religious liberty or broad degree of religious liberty, and others are very highly restricted?
That's a great question, and that's the essence of my book, that I want to understand why a government in an economic sense would deregulate religion. To think about this more generally, just why would a government ever deregulate any other industry? We've been through this with the airline industry, the telecommunications industry in the United States, and I'm just extending this to another aspect of society. I know many people don't think, well, that religion exists outside the economy. It's something different, something more sacred. I agree that religion is very sacred, but it still is a part of society that is regulated. So the question is, why would a government want to deregulate this part of society? And it should be pointed out that historically, religious liberty has not been the norm. You look back throughout history and you see government controlling religion. And throughout European history and many other parts of the world, you see that governments are very concerned about trying to control religion, because religious leaders have a great deal of influence. They can mobilize people against the population. They can mobilize people mobilize people against the government, but they can also mobilize people for a government. And so government officials have historically wanted to work closely with a favored or dominant religious organization and have oftentimes been very wary of newcomers. So the whole concept of deregulating a religious economy or a religious market is something rather foreign in history.
So what? Why do some governments choose to do it?
Well, one of the big issues, or one of the big theories that people have talked about in terms of why does religious liberty emerge, and mostly focused around issues of Great Britain and specifically the United States when it included the First Amendment into the Constitution, was the role of ideas. That John Locke during the English Enlightenment had a great idea. He wrote a letter of toleration and he said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we stopped all this religious fighting and just tolerated one another? And that starts people thinking. They're going, oh, well, yeah, maybe that's the good idea. We haven't done that for the past several centuries and let's construct a new idea. And the ideas essentially spread. James Madison picks up some writings by John Locke and says, oh, this is kind of interesting. Let's put this into effect. So that has been the predominant theory of why religious liberty emerged specifically in the United States, extending into Britain and a few other places. And there's something to that. You need to have ideas of freedom if you're going to have policies for freedom. However, and this is where I differ from a lot of the previous scholarship and why I titled my book The Political Origins of Religious Liberty rather than The Ideological Origins of Religious Liberty, is that at any given point in time, there's a lot of different ideas that are floating around society. Some of them are very good. Some of them are very bad. They're just different in many respects. And so the question for me became, well, why does one set of policy ideas get picked, whereas another set of policy ideas does not get picked? And it could be merely that there's just a great debate that goes on in society and one side wins the day, but I'm a little bit skeptical of that, and I think that there's something else going on here.
After all, there were no shortage, if we go to the case of Britain, there were no shortage of religious conservatives who said there should be absolutely no religious liberty, that dissenters should be suppressed, the established church should be supported, and Catholics should be continued to be denied civil rights.
Right, yeah. And one of my favorite instances, too, that I use in the book is that you hear in Virginia, which is the breeding ground for religious liberty. This is where James Madison includes a condition of religious liberty prior to the writing of the Constitution. Everybody thinks, well, you know, it's a hotbed of religious liberty there. But interestingly, within the Virginia legislature, there was a guy named Patrick Henry, the give me liberty or give me death idea, who was arguing for restrictions on religious liberty. He wanted to continue the Anglican establishment in Virginia, subsidizing the church. And it, as I understand it, and I wasn't alive during that period of time, but Patrick Henry was the more fiery speaker, the great orator that people would listen to and become convinced by because of his passion. James Madison just kind of mumbled his way through things. He has great intellect, no doubt about that. But he, when it comes to presentation skills, the historical record says he wasn't that good. So what you can see in Virginia is somewhat of a balance that, you know, a good portion of the population was for religious liberty, but there was other people, just like you mentioned in Britain, that were not for religious liberty. So what tips the balance? What tips the scale in one direction or not? And I want to focus this issue on the people who actually put pen to paper and write the policy. They're you know, a legislator, a president, whoever might be in charge of crafting the laws and putting them into effect. What motivates them to pick one set of policy ideas versus another set of ideas?
If it's not idealism or benevolence that really decides the issue, and it's really material interests, what kind of material interests prevail? And maybe you can use the example of colonial America to help illustrate that.
Yeah, and I want to caution you there on the one term. You said material interests. I just want to say interest in general, because when people look at me and they say, oh, you're a political economist of religion, they focus on that term economics. They say, oh, it's all just revenue, right? It's just all money game. And you know, as human beings, we are interested in money and resources. So we do have material interests, but sometimes we have other interests that go beyond a material interest. One of the things that I do in this book is say, let's sit down and figure out when it comes to putting pen to paper and writing laws that allow for religious liberty, who are the people involved? Who are the players? and what are their interests, be it material interest or non-material interest. And so I break this down. I often tell my students to do this too. It's a good way to understand history, is to, you know, find out who the important people in this political game are, the policy game, right? Down who they are and their interests are. And I start first and foremost with politicians. And this could be legislators, it could be an executive, it could be a dictator, an autocrat, a king, whoever it might be, the person who is in charge of crafting a law or a regulation. And I say, well, what do they want? Are there some generalities or generalizations that we can make about these political rulers? And there's certain things that political scientists have come to recognize as predominant interest among politicians, be they Democrats, a small d within a democratic polity, or autocrats, a dictator or a king. The first and foremost of these is political survival. That if you're a politician, you need to hang on to power. Well, you first need to get into power, but once you're in power, you want to stay in power, because the reason you're in power ostensibly is that you think you can do some things while you're in power. And if you're not in power, well, then you can't do those things that you want to. And so getting into power, but then staying into power becomes predominant. And so this idea of political survival here in the United States and in other democratic societies, we talk about the role of getting reelected. I need to please my constituents. That comes first and foremost above any other type of policy. So staying in office is the first thing politicians like to do. The second things that politicians like is to have tax revenue. That resource, and this gets to the material interest, that if you want to do things, if you want to please your constituents so that you can get reelected, or to appease some group in society so that they don't overthrow you, or appease the military so there's no coup, you're going to need resources to throw them some bones, essentially, to do things, to make policies, whether it's healthcare policies, whether it's fixing potholes in the local neighborhood. You need resources in order to do that. So resources, when it comes to a politician, is generally tax revenue. They want to increase the amount of tax revenue that they have. The third thing, and this is in a prioritized list, is economic growth, that politicians love to have their societies flourish economically, and for a number of reasons. First of all, that a growing economy will bring in more tax revenue, so that's very important. But also, a growing economy also makes people happy, right? That people's incomes are rising, they get the stuff that they want, and people who are living in an expanding, flourishing economy generally are pretty happy with the government, which enhances the politician's chance of political survival, being reelected or not being overthrown. So those three things are very important to politicians. Now, above those three things, politicians might have a myriad of other goals. They might be motivated by the writings of John Locke to implement religious liberty. They might be motivated to create national health care or fix roads, whatever it might be. They have different passions. But that is far down the list. And so for me, when it comes to looking at the individuals who are writing laws that relate to religious liberty, we have to think about, okay, how does this law on religious liberty, or the specific regulation that affects houses of worship, how does that affect political survival, tax revenue, and economic growth? Those things need to come into play here. So that's the first set of interests that I deal with.
But how does religious liberty advance? I understand you're very persuasive on those goals, the goals these policymakers are seeking. But I wonder, how does religious liberty advance those goals?
Well,
I mean, after all, religious liberty could cause discord, cause popular discord, which could, for example, threaten tenure, mm-hmm. or it could lead to expensive law enforcement or other challenges, which would come from the purse of the state. Mm-hmm. And third, they might do nothing to enhance economic growth. So why religious liberties?
Yeah, so this gets more to the context of the situation. You're absolutely right. There's that one thing that governments are wary of oftentimes when it comes to deregulating religion or to offering more religious freedoms is that, well, if we offer more religious freedoms, we'll get a bunch of wacky cults and sects coming into our government, and that's going to create discord, and everybody's going to start fighting everybody because they believe that their truth is the eternal truth and somebody else believes their truth. And that is not good for any politician. When your citizens start fighting with one another, your political survival is up in the air. So that really starts us to think about, okay, what else is going on in society? What are some of the other interests or actors that are here? And this is the other side of the equation of, okay, there are policymakers who put pen to paper and write religious liberty laws, but there are religious individuals and groups who are affected by them. And they have a strong interest in what is put on paper in terms of the rules of society. And so I look at what are the interests of religious organizations, of, let's say, churches, mosques, temples. We'll use the term churches here, thinking in Christian terms, but it really applies quite broadly to a number of different faith traditions. And in terms of any religious group, or most religious groups, is they want to be able to practice their religion in relative peace and do what they want, but they also want to proselytize. If they have the true answer, the one true God, you know, this is our truth, they typically want to spread that to other people in society. And so for them, for religious leaders, for religious individuals, trying to convince as many people as you can in a society that your ideas are right is one of the goals that they seek. Now, this creates a very interesting tension here, because wouldn't it be nice as a religious group if we went to the government and said, hey, we're the one true religion. Could you forbid all other religions? Now, that would be a huge imposition on religious freedom for religious minorities. So when it comes to religious groups, when I think about a dominant religion in society, one that is shared by a majority or perhaps a very strong plurality of members in a certain population, you will get those religious leaders wanting to restrict religious liberty. And so we need to think of, okay, so policymakers want political survival. If the dominant group in a society, 75% of them are one religion, that one religion is probably going to go to the leaders and say, well, you keep other religions out, because as soon as you start bringing other religions in, they're going to chip away from us, and they got weird ideas and things like that. And so dominant religions tend to like restrictions on religious liberty. So if you're in a situation where you have politicians interested in political survival and a dominant religion that is interested in keeping upstart sects out of the religious economy, you're probably going to get restrictions on religious liberty. On the other hand, religious minorities, the upstart sects, the ones who are trying to break in, saying, oh, this, we have some new ideas here and we want to convince people that our ideas are right, generally prefer a more liberalized religious economy. They want the opportunity to build their buildings. They want the opportunity to bring in their sacred texts. They want the opportunity to go door to door, knocking on doors, saying, hey, this is what we offer you. We know that there's a dominant religion here, but, you know, consider us for now. And so religious minorities will tend to prefer religious liberty. And so they will be lobbying for those religious freedoms. So that's the other aspect to this policy game. You have politicians want political survival, economic growth, and tax revenue, whereas on the other side, you have religious leaders sometimes wanting restrictions on religious liberty, especially if they're the dominant religion, but other times they don't want that. So now we need to start looking at the context of the situation. And this is where one of the empirical aspects of my book, I became very fascinated in the United States, colonial United States. And you see how this plays out in our history. There's one of the things that we often think about when we talk about the pilgrims, and we've had a few folks come and talk about that on our podcast before, is that, well, the pilgrims came over looking for religious liberty. Well, the reality of that story is that the pilgrims came over trying to escape religious persecution, trying to find freedom for themselves, that they were a persecuted minority in Britain, and the pilgrims specifically fled to the Netherlands, and then some of them came over to the United States, but also then other Puritans followed. When they landed in Massachusetts and set up their own society, their own governing rules and such, they were very quick to restrict the religious freedoms of others. And so you can see how these interests play out. When the Puritans were a religious minority in Britain and being persecuted, they wanted more religious freedom. when they came to an area where they became the dominant faith, it was, oh, don't let those Quakers come in and quake or those Shakers come in and shake. We have to prevent that. And for the first several decades, if not a century, the Massachusetts Bay Puritans were rather restrictive on the religious freedom of others. And this is why people like William Penn and Roger Williams, who didn't think that was that great of an idea, wanted to change that a little bit.
So if I think about if I'm thinking about your story, it strikes me that in some instant, if context seems to really matter, which puts some scope, maybe some scope conditions around the argument. So, for example, if the rulers of states are interested in economic growth, they might be interested in immigration.
Right.
And if those potential migrants are of a different faith, they will immediately confront this religious liberties issue because the existing established religious majority in their own country might say, we don't want immigrants because immigrants would be of a different religion. And if they come, we don't want to give them any rights or something like that. But of course, that then makes it less attractive for those immigrants to come. And especially in the case of, you know, because you mentioned the Netherlands is an interesting case, if you think about particularly attractive to states might be these commercially sophisticated or economically advanced minority groups. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Netherlands during the 17th century was famous for its tolerance. It still had an established Calvinist church, but its tolerance toward other religions, so long as those people were business people.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the things that the Netherlands found out, and it's part of the story here that leads to what happens in colonial America, is that once the king of France, and I think this was Louis XIV, may have been Louis XIII, rescinded the Edict of Nantes, where the Edict of Nantes tried to settle religious wars. Okay, you got French Protestants and French Catholics. Let's call an end to that. But over time, they said, no, let's not do that. We're going to restrict the rights of Protestants. These Protestants, the Huguenots, as they were known, you know, got up and left, and they said, where can we go where we're not persecuted? Well, they went to the Netherlands. And the folks who generally are the most mobile are the ones who are wealthier, are risk takers. Those are the kind of people you want in your economy. And these people flood into the Netherlands. And Netherlands, the mercantile sector of the economy, selling stuff, just flourishes. Like, wow, this is if you let people in who have, you know, maybe different religious ideas than you, it leads to economic growth. And oh, by the way, when people put things on ships and move it back and forth to other countries, we get to tax some of that. Isn't this a good thing too? And this is something that the Netherlands actually took into the U.S. colonies and really started the ball rolling in terms of people recognizing what is going on. Many people don't recognize or remember that New York was originally New Amsterdam, that the Dutch wanted to settle this territory, this island, and they said, okay. Let's set up a merchant ship here. People have beaver pelts and food and other things that they want to trade for. One of the first things that some of the settlers who got there wanted to do was to restrict the religious rights of minorities at the time. And the trading company, and there's documents to show this, they're in my book, the trading company comes in and says, whoa, don't you do that. Because the more you do that, the less people will come here. And what we need right now is settlers. We need warm bodies. And this was also something that the King of England, none too pleased with Puritans, also recognized too. Because you think about this, why would King Charles want the pilgrims going over and settling part of the new territories? Well, the point is he needed warm bodies there. Because there was a race to get this new continent out there. The French were getting into places. The Spanish were in the southern territories. And so you needed warm bodies. You didn't know who they were. And if you had some disgruntled people in your country, you know, say, hey, how would you like to go across this big pond and settle there? And people would say, okay, well, can we do what we want religiously? He says, yeah, fine, as long as you go there. And it was a good deal for King Charles at the time too, because you had all these dissenters causing conflict and the Anglican Church was all up in arms too. He says, well, you know, if you're a couple thousand miles away across water, you won't cause me that big a problem. And this became very recognized too by Roger Williams, one of the most famous dissenters amongst the Puritan dissenters who went over to Rhode Island. He says, well, he actually, it was interesting. He didn't think the Massachusetts Puritans were pure enough. So he was more of a fundamentalist preacher than the Puritans were. So you'd think, well, this guy's going to restrict religious liberty. But when he walks over to Rhode Island, the first thing he recognizes is that I need bodies, right? I can't do this alone. I need at least a couple other people around me. In fact, having a whole city of people around me would be financially beneficial. So let's get some immigrants here. And so attracting immigrants is a big, huge factor that the policymakers, be it Roger Williams, King Charles, or the monarchy in the Netherlands, recognize that, hey, if there are people that want to believe what they want to believe, if we want those people here, let's not restrict that. It's also a lesson, and in my book, I don't only talk about the colonial in the United States, but I talk about Latin America. This was an issue recognized early on by an independent Chile. And Chile, before the Panama Canal, was a pretty difficult place for Europe to get to. And early in their history, when Anglican traders would settle on the shores of Chile and say, hey, we have our wares and we'd like to plant some individuals down here to set up a trading post with you folks. Well, the Catholic Church said, arrest these people. They're Anglicans. They're, you know, not to be tolerated. And then you recognize, well, it's not a really good idea if you want to attract people to keep throwing them in prison. They just don't want to come anymore. And so Chile, one of the countries that is most trade dependent in Latin America, was one of the very first to open up religiously. And it wasn't a, you know, freedom of religion for all. They said, hey, Anglicans, come here. We won't throw you in prison. We'll tolerate you. You know, just don't go preaching and everything will be okay. But then that opens the door a little bit for further future liberties.
Yeah, toleration is often the first step. So, for example, if we think about the Dutch, for example, they were also highly tolerant towards the Jews, many of whom were refugees from Spain and other places, and allowed them to settle not only in the Netherlands proper, but as you mentioned, in the New World as well. And some of the oldest synagogues in the Western Hemisphere are in places like Curacao, where the Dutch allowed them to settle. But of course, that was only tolerance. That was always predicated on some pretty severe restrictions on their, for example, civil liberties and public presence.
Yeah, and that's a good point to note, is that religious liberty is not going to come wholesale overnight, but it's usually this small step-by-step process. Again, you know, again, based on these self-interests, is that, hey, you know, let's let Jews come to our country. They do a lot of good things economically for us. We like to have them. They're wonderful merchants. They're wonderful entrepreneurs, and, you know, we'll tolerate you. And over time, they prove themselves to be worthwhile citizens, and eventually their freedoms expand just bit by bit by bit. And that's what we see in the U.S. too.
You spoke a bit about the origins of the colonial experiment and the issue of religious toleration and expanding liberties at that period. But if we think about going forward a bit in the next century, that led eventually to the U.S. Constitution, which has two very important provisions, not only the Non-Establishment Clause, but also the other forgotten but very important provision, which says there can be no religious tests for the holding of public offices. How did we get from a rather limited idea about religious toleration to going so far as to at least to oppose a federal establishment of religion and to give everybody the right, in principle at least, to hold public offices, whatever their religious background?
Yeah, this happens again bit by bit, because one of the things that the Massachusetts colony, which is ostensibly the one colony that was really settled by a religious group, right, that got hold of the Puritans, that's where they fled to. Virginia, Georgia, those other places were merchant outposts, so to speak. But, you know, that is the big test. What happens in Massachusetts here? And early on in their history, they did have religious tests for office. You know, if you weren't a Congregationalist, you weren't going to be in office. And so those restrictions were in place for a very long time. But what happens from the 1620s, 1630s into the 1700s is religious pluralism starts to increase. So you do have a dominant Congregationalist faith that is there. And so they can pick up a number of, you know, there's always somebody there to be the mayor or to sit on the town council who is going to be a Congregationalist, and oftentimes they had very strict religious tests, but as more and more people of secular ilk were settled, they started to relax some of those requirements as well. The old halfway covenant, they realized if we have really high standards for religious adherence into our faith, nobody's going to meet those. And so we won't have anybody who's available to serve on our town councils or in our parishes. So they start to relax some of the rules over time. But what happens, again, because you're attracting immigrants, and New York is seeing a lot of pluralism. William Penn is encouraging pluralism because he wanted to settle Pennsylvania, and he recognized that the Quakers were a religious minority, and I better tolerate other religious minorities if I want them to come here. Rhode Island as well. Down south, you had the Anglicans, and starting in the 1700s, you start to see these new religious movements, these Methodists and these Baptists start appearing, and they're moving all over the place as well, and you see the rise of religious pluralism. And so, as we mentioned before, religious majorities or dominant churches will tend to want to restrict religious freedoms. But as pluralism starts to increase, you get this, I guess what international relations scholars would call a balance of power, where nobody becomes the dominant church, but rather you get a multiplicity of churches that nobody's the majority, and everybody's scared, well, if we make one church the majority and restrict political office only to this crowd, well, what happens if that other group becomes more numerous? Could they subvert our own liberties as well? And you see this start to play out in the colonies. As the revolution approaches, you have a very pluralistic religious market developing. And in different states, but they're starting to cross boundaries. They're doing it because they're trading with one another. And so there's Methodists, there's Baptists, they're all over the place. And then when it comes down to, well, we have to unify to fight off the Brits, there's this recognition that we all better get along pretty well. And if we do not, then you were going to die. It was the famous Benjamin Franklin flag. If we don't unite, we're going to die. And
hang together or hang separately.
Exactly. And I'm thinking the one with the snake that he had cut up. United we stand, divided we die. And people realized, okay, well, we better start tolerating one another. And then when it came to actually writing the Constitution, you had the period of the Articles of Confederation where states were predominant. But when it started to say, well, we really need to unify this thing, there was no one denomination that was a majority. Now in Massachusetts, the Congregationalists were still dominant, although pluralism was increasing. And they said, well, what should we make our national religion? Said, well, there is no 50% plus one religious group out there. So to pick somebody would be very difficult. And so the pluralism that resulted because of trade, because of the desire to attract immigrants, the pluralism, all religions realized that the best thing for my religious liberty is to respect somebody else's religious liberty as well. And again, let's not have a religious test at the federal level for any office, because some year it might be an Anglican, it might be a Congregationalist, who knows, a Baptist might even become president one day. And so that becomes an issue. Now, states, we need to recognize that states were still sovereign during that period of time and maintained their own constitutions. And Massachusetts was one of the big holdouts in terms of implementing religious liberty. Most other colonies, or when they became states, wrote their state constitutions. They said, we're going to have Methodists here. We're going to have Baptists. And Virginia is the one that leads this off. And they say it's just everybody plays on a level playing field. The Congregationalists in Massachusetts held off, I think, until about 1810 or 1812. And when it finally realized, pluralism is going to be the wave of the future here, religious pluralism. So let's just let everybody compete on a level playing field. So it's not only the interest of bringing immigration, and it's not only the interest of encouraging trade, which also brings tax revenue, but it's the religious pluralism. We don't want conflict. And if we favor one religious group that's maybe 30% of the population to the exclusion of 70% of the population, you're going to get conflict, and that's not going to be good. So, hey, let's all just get along. Here's freedom. And freedom is a great way for everybody to get along.
It's an interesting point. And one of the things I expect was probably happening to those holdout established churches after the formation of the Constitution was that in a situation of high pluralism where the establishment church may not actually have a majority of the population as its adherents, and those adherents may not have a great deal of voluntary participation, It also becomes extremely expensive for these states to continue to support established churches.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of the big deals that became an issue in Massachusetts was that the Congregationalist Church wanted the colonial governments to collect taxes for them and then to pay them. And as more people came in, and not only Methodists and Baptists and other folks, but there were a lot of seculars too. I mean, we don't recognize, we think that everybody who came over from Britain was a fundamentalist Christian in some way, respect or another. They probably believed in God, but there were a lot of secular people because the settlers were young males, 20, 21 years old, looking for their fortune. Those are not the churchy type. And they were chafing under the fact that they had to pay taxes to the church and stuff. And so one of the things that they always did was that whenever this church tax or any tax came around, is, well, I just get up and move. I hide my wealth, right? And you start realizing, well, if somebody's irritated with this tax and stops paying taxes altogether, you know, we're not going to get anything from them. So it was interesting for me that right around the 1740s or so, right around the time of the First Great Awakening or preceding the First Great Awakening, the Massachusetts government said, you know what, we're not going to collect taxes anymore if you're not, you know, for the Congregationalist Church, if you're not a Congregationalist. They still did it for Congregationalists, but they said, you know, if you want to be a Methodist, you don't have to pay the Congregationalist tax. What happens really interestingly, and this is one of the consequences of religious freedom, and I think a research paper needs to be written on this, but once that tax law was changed in Massachusetts, in the next year or two, you see the explosion of the Great Awakening, right? And as people say, oh, okay, and this emphasizes my earlier point is that, well, if you have to pay a tax to one church, why would I want to belong to another church and pay the tax to them? And all of a sudden, you're free to tithe to whatever church you want and say, okay, yeah, the Baptists look pretty attractive now. The Methodists, wow, you know, they waving their hands and having a fun time in those circuit riding carnivals, and wow, I think I will do that as well. And so you see freedom. You know, interestingly enough, a little small change in the law increased the pluralism. Then the pluralism created a brand new environment over the next couple decades where Massachusetts had to say, you know what, let's just have freedom.
Yeah, and at that point, deregulation, disestablishment becomes the only practical course and the only one that's not terribly expensive. I mean, we see this happening today with some of the established churches in Europe. For example, you might have heard about in the last couple of months, there's been a controversy in Germany regarding the Catholic Church. So the Catholic Church in Germany is an established confession, and this means that it is entitled to have the government collect a religious tax in its favor. Well, many people don't want to pay that religious tax and are dropping out, but still attend Mass. And as you probably heard, the Catholic prelates of Germany requested from the Vatican permission to deny the sacrament
to people
who attend but don't pay their church tax, which the Vatican approved. They are allowed to do that, which caused quite a uproar in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that whatever side one takes on that issue, it seems to me to be precisely the situation of an established church under pressure because of exactly the same kind of factors you're describing.
Right.
Growing pluralism, economic incentives not to be a member,
yeah.
Difficulty supporting an establishment when the share of people deeply committed to that establishment is falling, and so on.
One of the most fascinating things that I have found in the study of religion from an economic perspective is how churches finance themselves, because it's a rather interesting model. For a large part of I say at least contemporary times, churches have to fund themselves through voluntary tithing. There's nothing what us economists call menu pricing, that, you know, in order to come into the church, you have to pay $25 to get through the door. And if you want better seats, it's $50. They don't have any of that. It's all voluntary.
Although historically, they have tried those things.
They have, right. They have tried those things. They don't oftentimes work very well. But because a voluntary system of paying your tithe oftentimes leads to underpayment by people, you don't quite get to that 10%. Churches have always wanted to get some coercive help to do that. And this is where dominant religions, not only they want to be recognized by the state, but they want the state to fund them. Hey, could you collect the taxes for us? Because it's really hard. We pass the basket and nobody's putting stuff in. So if you just, when you guys collect taxes and you got some armed guy there saying you got to give some tax money, could we just have some of that? And that's always a very crucial aspect of religious liberty. And two, and we don't oftentimes think about this, but being coerced to pay a tax for something that you may not disagree with, that you don't want to participate in, it limits your freedom. Again, as I mentioned, oh, I got to pay the Catholic tax or the Congregationalist tax. Well, why would I want to be a Baptist then? Because I'd have to double dip, and boy, that's hard. So
if we think about some of the sort of general takeaway from your study, the incentives for rulers to establish religious liberty, maybe through a disestablishment or maybe through widening liberties or for greater toleration, there can be a variety of policy ways in which that is pursued, seem to respond to these series of economic and political incentives.
Yeah, I break in here just 1 minute, because I have to cite this one part. And this gets back to the colonial Americas again, when – and people say, no, this was all a battle of ideas. You're thinking about governments taxing and trying to encourage trade. You know, that's just silly. And there's this interesting passage here that during the 1750s, there was a guy named Samuel Davies. He later became the president of the College of New Jersey, also known as Princeton. He was a circuit rider, and he went around and he said that, King, when we go around circuit riding, our religious liberty is often restricted, and that's preventing people from coming in. It's preventing people from engaging in trade. So he made an appeal to the lords of trade in the colonies. These are the individuals who controlled the taxes and whether merchant ships could land here or there in there. And so it's interesting that he makes an appeal for religious liberty in front of these lords of trade, the board of trade essentially for the colonies, instead of going right to the king. He says, listen, you know, you want people to come, you want people to trade, you want people to move around, which is always good for the economy. Let them have religious liberty. And the lords of trade then petitioned the king for greater religious liberty in New Jersey. And this is what they said. This is a quote from in my book from the Lords of Trade dating back to the 1750s. They said, "A free exercise of religion is so valuable a branch of true liberty and so essential to the enriching and improving of a trading nation, it should never be held sacred in His Majesty's colonies." A very direct appeal to the financial interests of the king. So enriching a trading nation. And William Penn was also one of the people who earlier in colonial history said, listen, king, if you want your colonies to flourish, you have to enforce religious freedom, because that will bring a lot of different people, will encourage a lot of trade, and the more trade, the more the economy grows, the more the economy grows, the more tax revenue you have. So king, religious freedom.
I find that very compelling. So what you just sketched out there is a virtuous circle whereby there's sort of feedback effects.
Absolutely.
Whereby initial efforts to broaden religious toleration then grows to liberty, enhances commerce and trade. The economic and market expansion then provides even greater incentives to broaden that, attracts immigrants, pluralism grows up, and so on. We have this kind of virtuous circle. We can also imagine, of course, a vicious circle.
Right.
That is a relatively restrictive country with a backwards economy and an oppressive religious minority essentially dooms itself to increasing isolation from global commerce,
mm-hmm.
dooms itself to increasingly reactionary political posture.
Mm-hmm.
Isolates itself from liberalizing trends that would come about through through trade and through voices calling for greater toleration.
Yeah, you can see numerous examples of this throughout history. I mean, you look at the Soviet Union. When it came to power, it really went after its religious groups. Actually, you could think of Louis XIV and the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, or Republican France going out and restricting the church. Is that, you know, that generally is not very good for the population and not so good for the economy as well. Now, I'm not directly saying that, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union's economy in the 1970s and 80s was directly related to religious liberty, but it's a contributing factor. That really plays into that.
Restriction, for example, of the religious liberty of Jews led the Soviet Union to rid itself of some of its most prized human capital
the
and
brain
most
drain,
enterprising people.
Right? Yeah, and absolutely. You see people fleeing, and you might in many ways, you know, be seeing that too in places like Iran today, that people who want greater religious freedom, either for a different religious faith or to practice the dominant faith the way they want to, or just to be secular, have fled the country and you've come to the United States, come to Europe. And you know, again, the people who flee these places are often the risk takers, the ones who have the assets, the wealth to actually flee. They're very important people for your economy. And so you know, closing off those, you know, shutting down religious liberty really can affect a population.
And Spain certainly serves as an example of that. I mean, mm-hmm. after the Reconquest, mm-hmm. the driving out of the Muslims and the Jews, who were the predominant commercial and artisanal classes in the country, you know, many historians would say probably helped doom Spain's economy for a couple of centuries.
I would not doubt that. I don't specifically address that. But again, you can see how my friend Steve Pfaff here is just a storehouse of historical knowledge. I love it.
All right, I'm going to be a bit of a contrarian now.
Okay.
Now, you've sketched for us a very compelling narrative, well-rooted in general theory that mm-hmm. draws on insights of political economy to explain the ways in which religious liberty comes about largely not because of ideological changes, although there are those, or because people become more virtuous or tolerant, although there may be instances of that, mm-hmm. but largely driven by interests, material and non-material interests of rulers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one could draw an alternative narrative and say, well, wait a second. Isn't there an important cultural development? It stretches from Voltaire to Tom Paine to our own times to people like Christopher Hitchens that have tried and with increasing success to liberate humankind from the shackles of reactionary religion, superstition, backwardness, and intolerance. And as a result of this, broadening space for secular ideas and freedom from religion, that religious liberty actually thrives. And that couldn't some say that it's actually ideas of secularism and the process of secularization which really creates the opportunities that you're describing?
Yeah, that's an interesting case. Now, it depends on how we define this here, because many of the new atheists or going back to Voltaire, it was really not so much freedom of religion, but it was freedom from religion. That one group of adherents, the believers, were going to be extricated at the expense of another group, the seculars, the people who are more enlightened. One of the things I like about freedom of religion is that it's not only freedom of religion for Catholics and for Buddhists and for Muslims and for evangelical Protestants, but it's also freedom for atheists. It's one thing that the atheists and agnostics, especially the new atheists, might not really recognize that. You know, atheism can flourish in the United States. Why? Because evangelical Protestantism can flourish. And so the concern with the freedom from religion crowd that, you know, we need to be liberated from these ideas of religion is that, well, you know, are their ideas necessarily the best ideas? Not a lot of people would agree. And in order to get freedom from religion, you're going to have to repress or restrict the rights and freedoms of a large group of people who do have sincerely held beliefs. And that's one of the reasons why I tend to favor a religious market where such as the United States, where the government really doesn't get involved. And in many ways, I have a lot of evangelical friends that are worried that, oh, you know, the government doesn't put a Christmas tree up on the state house lawn in December. And he's like, you know, that's not really a big concern for me. I don't want them necessarily endorsing religion. I want them to play neutral. I just want them to play neutral. And in fact, if you know, you feel a little bit off-put in these societies. You feel like atheists are gaining ground because they have the freedom to be atheist and to speak their mind as well. Well, you know what? That means you just got to work harder to convince people as well. And that's one of the things that I think you can see in places, for instance, in Mexico, where the Catholic Church was essentially a legal non-entity for a good portion of the middle of the 20th century. It had to say, okay, we're – you know, a secular regime came in, made the church illegal, expropriated their property and stuff. And the Catholic Church said, well, you know, we have to work a little bit harder to convince people that we're a good thing. So a little bit of pushback from seculars is a good thing, I think, because it keeps religious groups a little bit honest and having to work hard for it. But again, if you're talking about freedom from religion, that is a little bit worrying because you do have to restrict what other individuals can do. And the other thing that worries me too is that if you get down to the point of freedom from religion. It's not a big step from freedom from other things as well. It can become a very tyrannical society, as we saw in the Soviet Union, in Mao's Cultural Revolution China.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, you know, because some people see secularism as providing – there's two versions of secularism. One version of secularism says, as you do, says, let the government not concern itself with religious matters.
Right.
Another one says, let's use politics to liberate people from backwardness and superstition mm-hmm. and intolerance and so on. And often motivated by understandable anti-clerical resentments or resentment against established churches, sometimes that form – took on the use of government to suppress religion in public life. And I agree with you. I think that that's tended to be a poor route to religious liberty. I mean, if we think about Republican France or the Soviet Union or Mexico under its secularizing, mm-hmm. After its secularizing revolution, this is often associated not just with real intolerance or discrimination or contempt for religious people, but often violent efforts to suppress them. Yeah, and stamp them out.
No, I absolutely agree. And one of my former students who we had on the show a while back, Ahmed Carew, really makes that case as well when it comes to thinking about how we deal with an increasingly secular society, or a society, I should say, and that's it's a tricky term, but a society that has a government that should play neutral with all religions. We can consider that to be a secular society, and I think that's what we have here in the United States, versus one that is aggressively secular. And he calls this assertive secularism, the revolutionary France that tries to stamp out religion or to promote a secular agenda above that. He pointed that out very well, then, that assertive secularism is trods on religious liberty just as much as a state church would in any given historical epic.
I'm largely convinced, but I want to raise the findings of a book by Stephen Monsma and Christopher Soper, two political scientists who I know you're very familiar with. In their book, The Challenge of Pluralism, they argue that the United States, with its rigid separation of church and state, actually goes too far. It's unnecessarily discriminatory toward religious groups by making it difficult for them to take advantage of government resources that are available to all other groups. What's your thought on this?
It becomes a difficult issue, and this is something that I've had discussed on this podcast before with Jay Hine and a few others about in the context of the faith-based initiative, wherein, you know, the United States seems to allow secular drug rehab centers or charity groups to compete for government grants, but religious organizations are prohibited because, well, we have a wall of separation. If you give Catholic Charities a grant to clothe the naked or feed the poor, then, well, my gosh, you're establishing religion. And I can see that case. It's a legitimate case that churches should be on a level playing field. There shouldn't be an effort by the government to stiff arm a religion at any given point in time. But when Monsma and Sopa in that book come down to advocating a certain model, they like the Netherlands, which currently has this system that is called pillarization, where each religious denomination is – you try to treat it equally, that you get equal funding. If you're Dutch Reform, you get this. If you're Catholic, you get amount based upon the number of people that you have. The problem that I have with that is the government becomes too restrictive in determining what the boundaries for religion are. You belong to this pillar or that pillar, or you get this amount of funding and based upon your membership. And it creates a lock-in effect that doesn't allow people to move between religious traditions or to drop out of religious traditions. And I'm very wary of that. Now, I understand their concern that the U.S. government might be a little bit too secular in favoring secularism over other religions. But again, a little bit of that I actually don't think is a bad thing. That the fact that, you know, in the past here in the United States, it's been very difficult for religious charities to get into the government grant thing, for me is an okay thing, because then they have to focus on their constituents. They have to go to their parishioners, their congregants, and say, you know what, we want to build a charity here and we need you to support it. And you have to make a very strong case for it, rather than turning to some government bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. who says this is the charity of the month, the flavor of the month, and then you modify your grant to it. The government becomes much more in tune with setting the dimensions of charity than rather the religion does. So, you know, in terms of that question, I'm okay with it a little bit. And if religions feel pressured by government that they don't have equal access, well, then you just find ways to build private associations within society. And so long as the government doesn't prohibit your ability to associate, to buy property, to help you associate, well, you know, being on your own is actually kind of a good thing.
I see your point. I mean, Monsman Soper can point to some interesting developments in the Netherlands. For example, despite the fact that this pillarization system was a traditional one, which largely was done to accommodate, as you said, Protestants and Catholics, it has been open to newcomer religions. So, for example, now Jews and Muslims, for example, now have shares also of those public resources in the Netherlands. So they can also organize, for example, religious schools that benefit from public funding. Yeah. Even Britain allows religious schools with public funding.
Yeah. And you know, if it's a fairly loose regulatory system, then it's not necessarily that bad. But, you know, what about the new groups? Does it make it harder for new groups to come about? And it's a difficult empirical question to answer, because this goes back to Bastiat's old seen and unseen things. Is you can say, well, you know, we're offering these monies and the support to all religions equally, but some of them already have it. And so what does it take for a new religion to do it? Well, they have to prove that they're worthy. You have to prove you have so many members, you're not a weird, strange human sacrificing cult or things. Some of those just might not appear. And if they don't appear, we don't know if they're not appearing because of the regulation or just because they're not appearing because they never really existed in the first place. And the only way you can really, you know, find out whether religions flourish or not in a free environment is to allow freedom to reign and to see what happens.
I think it's a good point. You know, it also can put secular officials in a very ticklish position. So, for example, in the research that you and I did, Tony, on Germany, we found that one of the issues that made it difficult to, for example, treat Islam as a confession in Germany was there was not a clear consensus among Muslims which Islam would be the authentic Islam that would be established by the church. So who should make the decision? Secular judges? Government officials?
Right.
Not so clear. I remember a recent case that came up along these lines in Britain where it fell to a secular judge in an ordinary civil court to try to decide what counted as a Jew, because there was an issue of someone who had been converted to Judaism to attend a particularly desirable school. And religious authorities said, well, wait a second, we don't recognize that conversion. We think it was an opportunistic conversion. And the judge was in a position of saying, well, under the law, as we see it, this, from a secular point of view, this is a good enough conversion and this person should be admitted to the school, right? And so situations then come up where, you know, that are going to create the kind of tensions that you point out.
Yeah, and this goes back to the original point we were talking about, what constitutes religious liberty is that these small little changes in rules really define the boundaries of what is acceptable religious behavior and what is not acceptable religious behavior. And, you know, I'm not of the mindset to be a religious anarchist and say, well, you know, everything goes. There has to be some reasonable limits in society. But whenever it comes down to looking at a policy that is made, I always tend to defer toward greater religious liberty, or, you know, greater religion, greater liberty in general would be my default position.
Let's close with this question.
Okay.
You mentioned the work of Brian Grimm and Roger Finke, and in their book, The Price of Freedom Denied, they argue that religious freedom, in both the negative and positive senses we've talked about, are vital to real human rights and really are a bellwether for democracy. When religious rights are denied, civil and political rights also tend to be restricted. And they show in their book that, generally speaking, the places around the world today that have the best opportunities for religious freedom are also tend to be the most democratic and the most prone to protect civil liberties. Do you agree that religious liberties are vital to the exercise of democracy and to the expansion of human rights? And if so, why?
You use the term bellwether there, and I really like that term. And you touch upon an area of research that I'm plunging into full steam ahead right now, that what I call contingent liberty, that religious liberty is a great thing, but it relies upon so many other liberties, such as the right to own property, the right to congregate, the right to free speech, the right to association, to form a group, to form a corporate group that has some kind of corporate entity that outlasts the people who originally formed the organization. Those things are so vital to religious groups, but they're vital to everybody else in society as well. And sometimes I get very frustrated where folks in the religious communities become very entranced with defending religious liberty, but don't consider other liberties to be all that important. And I say, you know, your religious liberty is contingent upon a lot of other liberties. In fact, I often like to point out that the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which does enshrine the freedom to worship, has a lot of other liberties there, and they're not separated by periods. They're separated by semicolons, which means they're related. So the right to free speech, to free press, to association is intimately related to our religious freedom. And in a broader perspective, our fight for religious freedom, if we consider that to be a virtuous good that society should have, will really benefit a lot of people who might not be religiously inclined, because it will help them as well build their freedoms as well.
I think that's an excellent place to end in the season of peace. And so I just want to say thank you to Tony Gill for offering me the chance to be the guest host on the program this week.
And thank you, Steve. Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.